brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. The assault on our social safety net, well, it's ramped up into hyperspeed as the wealth class sees their chance to cut larger holes in it so more people fall through. We're going to talk about the assault on the SNAP program as the Republicans, who are really pushing this policy of we're going to feed the big multinationals, feed the big corporations, but you people at the bottom, you hungry people, screw you. You should work harder, be less lazy, because that's the point. That's what they keep telling us. Oh, you're lazy, you're stupid. You just don't work. You don't want to work. You want free stuff. Nonsense. Going to talk about that. Also, the New Jersey primary has wrapped up. Looks like another bad Democrat's going to be seated in the U.S. Senate. I guess it's better than a worse Republican, I guess. But we'll talk about what it means for New Jersey now that Cory Booker is the guy going to be sitting in the Senate. What's going to mean to the rest of the country? His positions on education should be very interesting. Also, education under attack. You got to love the situation here in Harrisburg, though. Teachers, you take pay cuts, pay more for your health care, or we're going to fire you. We're going to fire a bunch of you, and we'll take that money that we're quote-unquote saving, well, taking from you, and we're going to hire a cyber director. So that we can kill off public education quicker. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, that really is, that is the GOME way. That is the benevolent dictator way, is it not? Also, we're going to talk about fun, a little more fun with guns. Not such a good day for puppies and much, much more. Your questions, comments, thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, before we get into the program, this story that someone emailed me today has had me thinking all day long. I've been saying for the longest time, we get people elected into office who don't believe in government. They come out and they tell you, I don't believe in it. And I'm going to do everything I can possibly do to destroy it. I mean, you look at the current Republican majority here in Pennsylvania, and a good number of them are of that ilk. Don't believe in government. Don't believe that it can do anything. It needs to be limited. It needs to be neutered. It needs to be, well, strangled, dragged into a bathtub, drowned. That's the current Republican view of what they're in charge of. So is it any surprise that nothing gets done? Is it any surprise that what they touch turns to you-know-what. But I saw this story, and thank you for the email, of an 18-year-old kid who's running for the mayor of Roy, Utah. And you go, well, you're an 18-year-old kid running for office. That's actually a good thing. We want young people to be civically engaged. We want them to participate in their government, right? Well, it turns out that this kid, when he was 16, was part of a bomb plot to blow up his high school. And I said, you know, this is exactly what I'm talking about. This kid could win. And I'm going to keep this on my radar for November 5th when the election in Roy, Utah happens. Because there's part of me that goes, there's got to be some yahoos out there going, yeah, that kid, he's got some smarts on his shoulders. Just blow it up. Yeah. Now, the kid who's running says, you know, time in juvenile detention helped me clear my head. Put me on the right track. Jail does one of two things, I guess. But, you know, he was going to, you know, follow out like Columbine kind of shooting in his high school, him and another kid. He was fortunate, though, at 16, they didn't try him in his adult. So he can technically, he can be mayor. His record was sealed. There's nothing in adulthood that will follow him. He claims he's been rehabilitated. Did his 6 months. It was a bad idea. You know, I got my head screwed on right now. Back then, I was thinking, blow the school up, kill a bunch of people. Yeah, no problem. I was having a bad day. Bad day. Now, some people in the town not happy because, you know, he's going to cost the township money for a primary that they wouldn't have otherwise had to spend. So they're not happy about that. So it'll be interesting to see November 5th where he is. But this is the kind of people that Republicans, I think the, you know, not the sane, rational, reasonable Republicans, these new radical extremists that have taken over and taken hold of the GOP, they're the ones who I think would vote for a guy like this. And for me, we've got to get back into a a civic view, into a societal view that there are things government can and should do. And we want to make them as good as possible. We want to run them as efficiently as possible. We want people who actually believe in what they're doing, doing the job, right? I mean, are you going to hire a guy, a brain surgeon who goes, I don't really like brain surgery. I kind of like, I wanted to be a podiatrist when I grew up. But brain surgery was all they had open. Would you go to the brain surgeon? Of course you would not. Come on. So why would we vote for people who are dim-witted and, I don't believe in it, so vote for me. But tonight I headed to a place, down in York, where a guy is running for governor who gets it. Really a super nice guy, not really a politician. I wish he was more of a politician, but a nice guy, a businessman who gets it. Tom Wolf opened up his York office, and I went down to, to talk to people down there, see why they were interested in Wolf's candidacy, what brought them out. Kind of as a reporter thing, going down to talking to people, and in a room full of 100 some people. Every one of those people knew him personally, had dealings with him, and nothing but glowing things to say about what he had done for the community and what he's done for York and the state. And I'm standing there going, these are the kind of people that we need in public office. People who are going to actually work for everyday average people. People who know how to create jobs for one, but also understand that the government plays a role in that. Look at the last 3 years now, since Corbett and the Republicans have grabbed absolute control. What have they actually accomplished? Oh, we got a budget done three years in a row. Well, two, this third one, there's some question. Even some Republicans are questioning that. How many jobs plans have gotten through? How much of our infrastructure has been improved? What have they done to education? What have they done to alleviate poverty? What have they done to make society better? I just listed it. Did you hear it? Let me list them again. Oh, yeah, that last one was a good one, wasn't it? Here, let's go through that list one more time. There's nothing, is there? There's nothing you can point to say, this is what they've done to make our state better. Nothing. And, as I was down talking to the folks there in York, they get it. They got the fact that there was the Republicans had opportunities, but they've squandered them. When they came in 2010 and were talking the jobs talk, which I think everybody agrees we need to have a solid jobs plan, by building a solid set of policies that's going to encourage growth and not low road growth. And I know our new jobs, our more jobs governor's been out and, giving away money because he thinks that's the way you bring people here. It's not. Pennsylvania's got a great location. We still have good education. They're working on destroying that, but, still. On the better side of many of the other states. And, of course, our infrastructure, which needs lots of work. Now, me, if I'm sitting in the governor's mansion, I'm saying if I want to get reelected, the best way to do that is we need people back to work. What do we do with it? Well, we put people back building the roads and bridges and our infrastructure, broadband access, public transportation, all kinds of things to get people back to work. Because, a little bit later we're going to talk about, one of Corbett's little ribbon-cutting ceremonies here where they gave away a bunch of money. I mean, we're giving away boatloads of money to bring companies here because we compete for them with big checks. But what I find interesting is they're willing to give out very low-interest loans to all of these companies. They float bond initiatives, and then they loan that money out at a very low rate to these companies in the hopes that, they'll come and they'll create jobs. Not really happening so much. I mean, we're giving away a lot of money, but the jobs thing, kind of lagging. I'm of the mindset, if we're going to do that, why not cut out the middleman and say, you know what? Let's give people a reason to come here because we're on the cutting edge of alternative energy. We're on the cutting edge of internet access for everyone and high-speed internet for everyone, public transportation and high-speed public transportation. Let's be innovative and do things differently than here's a check. Because here's a check only lasts for so long. Because here's a check, you know what that does? That defunds everything else. And I look at what's going on in Philadelphia, where they weren't going to open the doors. Not opening the doors to the school district because the guy who was the superintendent said, you know what, we don't have the resources to provide a safe environment and a learning, nurturing environment in our school district given the resource. We need $50 million. And you know, like we talked to the woman last night, she said, yeah, we should have been asking for the whole $300 million that they gutted from us, not just the 50. Well, the Corbett people said, well, we'll give you 45 if those teachers take more cuts. So even with this, with our kids' future, they've got to be political. It's got to be a political spin on it. Okay, we'll give you something, but you got to make them hurt. I mean, really, very Machiavellian if you think about it. Take our enemy out in public and gut them in public. This is exactly what they're doing, and it's what they're masterful at. So while I wouldn't be surprised if this kid in Utah wins, I am surprised when I see Republicans in our state wanting to blow things up. And to me, the ends are just the same. The means are just a means of getting to the end of destroying what we the people have built. Which is why the coming next several months, it's going to be very interesting to see who the Democrats put forth to run against Corbett. And we're going to try and get most of the candidates here on the program to talk about the issues that I think are important. Education, extremely important. Investing in our roads and bridges, investing in our state, very important. Not just handing out checks and saying, here, please come, but actually investing. Something we used to know a little bit about. Something we've seemed to have forgotten. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced Monday that he's mandating Department of Justice reforms to some nonviolent drug offenses. In his speech before the American Bar Association, Holder said there needs to be a greater focus on treatment and less on long prison terms. Holder specifically called out the impact draconian sentencing laws have on communities and families, saying many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate this problem rather than alleviate it. Part of Holder's plan includes not charging low-level nonviolent drug offenders in the same way as members of large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels. Holder's speech complements a push in Congress to reform sentencing. One measure in the Senate would give judges greater discretion in drug sentencing. Chicago's growing movement for social and economic justice is manifesting in broad action across a number of issues as grassroots people struggle against the corporate agenda. Doug Cunningham reports.
The people's movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is justice for working people facing foreclosure. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bank disruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is and working to take back the city because it's ours.
Passengers traveling through the Vancouver International Airport over Canada's Labor Day weekend could be facing a strike line. Workers for the Airport Authority voted overwhelmingly in favor of taking job action over a push by management to implement a two-tier wage system and contract out work. The 300 workers are the backbone of the airport, and it's unclear how a strike would impact travel. The workers are represented by the Public Service Alliance of Canada and the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
Decision, that's all. What bad circumstance? I mean, that's how you get. It's your fault that you ended up in poverty. You were born. Yeah, that was it. That's the bad decision for the vast majority of people who live in poverty today. And, you know, I love this empowering opportunities, gateways out of poverty initiative the Republicans are pushing through. They've had, since July 15th, they've had one meeting. I was told they were going to go across the Commonwealth, a listening tour. They were going to ferret out poverty, one meeting. But they did play poor for an hour, so that's something, right? Anyway, here to help talk to us a little bit about what's going on in the state and also one of his education initiatives. I've got Pennsylvania State Representative Brendan Boyle, also a candidate for the U.S. Congress 13th Congressional District. Brendan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
So I look at Chairman Reed, who has this poverty initiative. Have you heard of it, the Empowering Opportunities Poverty Initiative?
I didn't realize the Republicans acknowledged poverty existed, so I guess that's sort of progress, right?
Yeah, I mean, they played poor for an hour. That's a start. But, you know, they told us they were going to go on this grand tour. They were going to ferret out poverty. They were going to go where it is. They've had one meeting in Clearfield County where they talked a little bit about poverty.
Well, I can't say I'm terribly surprised, although the irony is, and I always point this out, a lot of their members actually represent areas that have a high concentration of poverty, and if they would spend less time beating up on Philadelphia and more time worrying about folks in their own districts who actually are quite poor and figuring out ways to help them, I think it would probably be a lot better for society.
I absolutely agree. But, you know, I've been taking the position that, you know, what they're going around doing is they're borrowing the Bush banner, the Mission Accomplished banner, because a lot of their policies, in my view, and you don't have to agree, but a lot of their policies, the way I see it, make poverty worse. And there are a lot of things we could be doing to help make poverty better that they refuse to do.
Well, I'm actually going to have an op-ed that hopefully the Philadelphia Inquirer will publish soon that talks about the fact that for 40 years we've ignored poverty and that we really need to resuscitate this as a political issue. And some things that I'll talk about later about that we can do both at the federal and also state level to return the focus on poverty. And also the fact that, yes, you do have poverty in urban areas, but, you know, and I always cite the statistic, there are two counties in Pennsylvania that are tied for the highest percentage of residents under the poverty line. Philadelphia is in that tie with Fayette County. And the next four counties after that are all rural areas. So the idea that this is somehow just a city problem or urban problem, just completely false, that, that you have poverty in urban areas, you have poverty in rural areas, and the biggest growth of the number of poor people is actually today in suburban areas.
Yep. Well, because they lost their jobs.
You had a 40% increase in poverty over the last 5 years in Philadelphia. In Montgomery County, the wealthiest county in Pennsylvania, it wasn't a 40% increase. It was a 122% increase
wow.
in the number of residents underneath the poverty line. And those are the kind of things I think a lot of people really just don't pay attention to.
You know, for me, the discussion, and I was, I got to be honest, for about 15 seconds, I was hopeful that Chairman Reid was truly genuine. And this, we're going to ferret out poverty. We're going to do what's best. But I look at the budget and the cuts to education, and I look at, you know, I go back and I think about kicking 41,000 people off the adult basic. I think about,
right.
you know, 89,000 kids off the CHIP. I think about doing away, eviscerating the general assistance budget. All of these things that, well, helped alleviate some measure of poverty, they made worse.
Well, and not to mention the cutting $1 billion from education as well.
Well, over the last 3 years, absolutely. $3 billion over that time period. You're absolutely right. And I look at what's going on in Philadelphia, and, you know, the school, I got to give you credit. I give the superintendent of that school credit for saying, you know, we're not opening the doors. I think that
yeah.
was a bold move.
We were literally just a couple weeks away from schools not opening in Philadelphia, despite the fact the state constitution guarantees an education to our citizens. It's a pretty dramatic situation we're in. And I sent a press release on Friday. I called on the governor and the House Speaker to call us back in the session. We're not supposed to return in the session until late September. We should be there at work now coming up with a solution. Because, again, even though this problem is most pronounced in Philadelphia, there are actually 19 school districts that are considered distressed school districts. Chester, Duquesne, we have a number of other, Harrisburg, we have a number of other areas in the Commonwealth that are, you know, unfortunately about to face the same problem or already facing it. Let's come up with a solution now. I mean, why are we waiting till last week of September when school starts most places the week of Labor Day? That just doesn't make sense. And especially, you know, we have Governor Corbett, whose approval rating is somewhere like in the high 20s, low 30s. If he would get his head out of the sand, here's an opportunity to actually lead and attempt to be a problem solver, and you just don't see him at all. It's really bizarre.
Well, he was kayaking. And come on, you know, kayaking.
Yeah, probably.
Kayaking's fun.
I've gone kayaking a couple times. It is fun. You know, probably the school's not opening is slightly more important than his little wonderful kayaking tour of Pennsylvania.
But the sad thing is, you know, you talk about things that make poverty better. Education being the number
right.
one thing, in my view, outside of jobs. I mean, you want to talk about how we fix poverty? How about jobs? How about raising the minimum wage? How about taking the Medicaid expansion money so we get more people covered with health care and more people getting jobs so we have a spiraling up? There's a lot of policy things that we could be doing other than pointing the finger and saying, well, you're poor because you made a bad decision, or you're poor because of a bad circumstance, or you're lazy or stupid.
Well, you know, and I mean, you know, probably Rick from last time I saw you was at the Teamsters convention when I spoke there and was very proud to be endorsed by them. My dad was a Teamster for 25 years. He came as a 19-year-old, as an immigrant from Ireland, was a laborer, was a warehouseman for Acme Markets for 25 years and a proud Teamster. Unfortunately, then Acme Warehouse closed their Philadelphia operation to escape paying union wages and moved to a different part of the state. And in the last 15 years, my dad has been a maintenance worker with SEPTA. You know, if it wasn't for the labor unions that my dad was a member of, AFSCME, that my mom was a member of, they would not have had, and, you know, they weren't rich. We didn't grow up rich, but they had at least wages that they could raise two kids on, both of whom went on to serve in the state legislature, myself and my brother. And both of us went to college. I'm the first in my family to go to college, my brother the second. If it wasn't for labor unions that fought for fair wages and benefits combined with educational opportunity, both my brother and I would not have had the opportunities that we've been fortunate enough to have in life. So, I mean, if you look at someone like me, why am I so pro-labor? You know, why do I so strongly believe in education? It comes straight from my personal experience.
You know, to me, Brendan, that's something I don't think we hear enough of. Those are stories that, because mirrors mine. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. Had it not been for the contract that I worked under, because I worked hard, but I could have worked hard making half of the money and still living in poverty.
Right.
I don't think it's a message we hear enough.
No, I think it's important that for folks like us get that message out, so that way people realize that poverty is real. It's not something to be ashamed of. You do need government. I look at myself. I consider myself someone, you know, if you're going to pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you at least need to start with the boot and the straps, right?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, certainly I needed to work hard, which I did. I needed initiative, which I had. But I also needed student loans, which helped me get there. I also, you know, if my parents hadn't made any money at all, I wouldn't have been able to afford the educational opportunities that I had. So, and yes, I needed scholarships, student loans, work study. By the way, if work study programs didn't exist or student loans didn't exist, I still wouldn't have been able to get to college even with hard work and initiative and winning a scholarship. So,
let's talk about that.
The fact is, it takes all of these.
Well, let's talk about that because, you know, you hear that a lot. You know, the kids want to go to college, can't afford it. The parents don't have the money. They can't be saddled with massive debt. There's got to be a way to move forward. And last night we talked to a friend from Oregon who talked about their pay it forward laws. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea to make sure that if you can do the work, if you can keep up, if you can graduate, it should be there for you. And then as you gain an income, you pay it back over the time.
Correct.
So the next generation gets, I think we used to understand that in this country, didn't we?
Well, and that's exactly my philosophy. And I can tell you that, so just to take a step back, you know, I've been in the state house, this is my fifth year. Literally the first bill I introduced was something called the REACH Scholarship. Basically it's modeled off the HOPE Scholarship in Georgia, which enables, students in Georgia and a couple other states followed it after Georgia, like Florida. You're able to go to a public college or university tuition-free in those states as long as you have a minimum 3.0 or 3.2 GPA. Some states it's 3.0, others it's 3.2. As long as you have that GPA as a high school senior and you maintain it as a college student, you are able to go to college tuition-free. So in Georgia, it's called the HOPE Scholarship. In Florida, it's the Bright Futures. I introduced it along with a former colleague of mine, Tony Payton. We called it REACH. So every state calls it a different acronym, but it's essentially the same idea and the same model. So I've been pushing for that. The farthest we've gone is it passed the House Education Committee unanimously, actually, a couple sessions ago, and then it just completely stalled. So I've been trying to figure out ways to reinvent the higher education model in terms of funding and how we can enable more kids from working-class backgrounds and middle-class backgrounds and poor backgrounds to afford college. So REACH Scholarship is one idea. And then I read about this Oregon program, and I've been studying it for the last few months. I think it makes a lot of sense. So I introduced that as well, and I modeled my bill exactly after what they've done in Oregon. I know two other states, New Jersey and Washington State, are both looking to do the same thing. But I look at it as if you have another state out there that's doing something that works, no need to reinvent the wheel. You know, you have 50 different states out there. They were called the laboratories of democracy. Let's intelligently study what's working elsewhere and adopt those best measures here for our state.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's, I got to tell you, it's one of the things I like about you. You're not the kind of guy who'd kick the ladder behind you so nobody else can get up the ladder after you.
No, thank you.
Too many of the people that I know who have reached a level of success, they want to slam that door behind them so nobody comes up behind them, because that's what this, a lot of the policy, it seems to be. So walk me through this pay it forward thing as you see it. How would this work? I got kids that are in second and sixth grade now. How's this going to work if, let's say, we put it into place? How will it work for them going forward?
So the way it would work, and the challenge is the bond issuance that you'd have to do, because much like Social Security, it's sustaining generation through generation, but the challenge is actually coming up with the upfront dollars, which is why that you would have to do a bond issuance.
Right.
So that way you can have the upfront money, because then the succeeding generations that are paying back through loans are paying, you know, a percentage of their income and paying it forward, that would be enough to sustain future generations. So that's the way that that is envisioned. The think tank that came out with this report in 2012, that's what the Oregon Pay It Forward model is based on. And, you know, by the way, I'm agnostic, actually, on this issue. If you notice, I've introduced the REACH scholarship. I've introduced the Pay It Forward. I have a very simple philosophy. If you can study it and it's demonstrated to work, I'm in favor of it. Some people want to poke holes for this idea. I say, great. Please give me what your idea is.
Right.
Let's work together. Because you know what? What we're doing now, it is not working, Rick. We have the second most expensive public colleges and universities in the country. And guess what? Pennsylvania students graduate from college with more debt than almost any other state in the country.
Well, how much does that have to do?
How in the world can we sustain a bright future economically if we have students graduating saddled with debt? That just makes no sense.
How much of that do you think is the fact that, in my opinion, the state has walked away from higher ed? And, you know, I point to a statistic that Steve Hicks, the president of APSCoF, told me not too long ago, that in the 1980s, the state picked up about two-thirds the cost of an education.
And now it's about one-third, right?
And no, it's actually less than that. They pick up about 25%. Tuition is now three-quarters the cost of education, which a complete turnaround. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth. That is a massive redistribution of wealth.
Well, and it's funny to show you the situation has gotten worse, because when Steve sat in my office a few years ago, he had told me one-third, so it shows you the situation's even gotten worse since then, that he said it used to be two-thirds, and now it's one-third, but of course now, today, it's actually even less than that. So that is part of the problem, and I think that's the majority of the problem, but it's unfair to say that that's all of the problem. I do challenge, and when I'm a member of the House Appropriations Committee, I grilled some of the university presidents of Penn State, Temple, and Pitt on this, that unfortunately there's been a keeping up with the Joneses philosophy in higher education and sort of this arms race of build the most beautiful dorm and do the most in research and let's have the best gymnasium, and some, as opposed to putting those resources toward grants and cutting tuition and student loans. So while the majority of the problem is because state legislatures, not just in Pennsylvania, but throughout the country, have walked away from their responsibility to properly fund higher education, that is the majority of the problem, but also some of those institutions in higher education do bear some of the responsibility for not keeping tuition rates reasonable, as much of a goal as it should be. Keep in mind, every single one of the last 30 years, college tuition has risen greater than the rate of inflation. That's unsustainable.
I'm right there with you. Let me ask you. You talked about a bond issue. How expensive is a bond? How expensive would a bond be right now? It's my understanding that we can borrow money almost free at this point. How expensive would it be?
Well, and this is a great point to push back on the Tea Party anti-government folks who are so obsessed with deficit and debt. This is actually the lowest debt servicing cost ever. For government to pay, both at the federal level and the state level. At the federal level, international bondholders are actually paying us to hold their money when you take in the real rate of return. So this is actually, if you're going to issue debt, this is a better time to do it now than at any point in the last 100 years.
So why can't we get any of your colleagues to come along with a transportation bill, this kind of thing, any investment? Why can't we get the Metcalfs and the Corbetts to come along?
Well, and you know what amazes me about that transportation bill, Rick, when it was June 29th, that final weekend we were there, my brother and I, at like 1 o'clock in the morning, we roomed together when we're in Harrisburg, and we were sitting up late saying, "Wow, it looks like it's finally going to happen. Transportation is going to happen. It's going to be over $2 billion. The state senate, you know, they passed it 45-5 months ago." Then Saturday morning, in the House Republican leadership, it all fell apart because they couldn't get more than 50 votes for a measure that passed almost unanimously from the state senate and was supported even by a Republican governor. That's how conservative the leadership on that side is.
See, I'm not gonna agree with you on the conservative nothing. These are radicals.
Right.
I respect honest, decent conservatives. These folks are radicals. These are extremists who I think have poisoned the Republican Party.
Well, you know, it's a fair point. You know, in House Appropriations Committee, when we're talking about transportation, I wish I could remember it verbatim now, but I read a quote from their hero, President Ronald Reagan, talking about, in 1983, talking about the importance of government spending for infrastructure and transportation. The quote that I read, in today's context, you would think it was Barack Obama saying it.
Yeah, it's insane. Last line of questioning I've got for you. Running for Congress. Tell me, how's it going?
It's going extremely well. I'm very grateful for the support that I have from the working men and women of my district. 18 different labor unions, and usually they don't get involved in primaries. This has been an exception. 18 different labor unions have come out and endorsed me, from the PA Conference of Teamsters to every single one of the Philadelphia building trades, Unite Here, the Communication Workers, Transport Workers Union, Fraternal Order of Police, firefighters. 18 different unions have endorsed my campaign. No other candidate has more than one endorsement in this race. And I think the folks know that I've been someone the last 5 years, whether as a member of the House Labor Committee or just as a general member, has been there 100% of the time for working men and women. It's something that I'm passionate about, and I can be a champion for them in Washington, because God knows working people need that right now.
I'm right there with you. And when you get to Congress, you got to come back and talk to us and keep us informed as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love the show.
Thanks so much. VoteBoyle.com, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Representative Brandon Boyle's name. It'll take you right there. Brandon, it's always great to talk with you. Appreciate the time, brother.
Great, Rick. Look forward to next time.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people. On the top.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public, as well as with co-workers, are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover. For staying home means a loss of pay, or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable, and since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only failed to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying, all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline, groceries, and our hazes. Everything's raising but the wages.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Good news for Pennsylvania. The more jobs governor was on the road. Yes. Yes, the more jobs governor was in the Lehigh Valley. Big move. Big win for Pennsylvania. Big win. This defense contractor from New Jersey was evidently in a place that, you know, they weren't happy with. It was falling down. The building was outdated. You know, it was one of the old Ingersoll Rand plants. You know, it just needed some upgrades. So instead of, you know, reaching into the company's pocket and saying, hey, we should invest in, you know, and upgrade our stuff, let's put it out to bid and see what other states are willing to give us if we come. Well, Pennsylvania won. Yay! The defense contractor, multinational Curtis Wright Corporation, they make pumps and valves and engines for defense contractors. I mean, so they get a lot of money from the government anyway. You know, it's a good private sector job, right? It's a good private sector company. Private! Out there in the private sector. Of course, taking all government money. Don't say anything. The news was is that the contractor was going to move from all the way from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, all the way to Bethlehem, PA, which is about, 20 miles. And for their big move into the state-of-the-art 179,000-square-foot complex, going to be opened by the end of the year. Hooray! This big win we got, according to Allison Carner, the Economic Development Administrator for Northampton County, because, they were competing. This was heavy competition. But she says, this isn't your grandparents' manufacturing. No, this is advanced manufacturing. People need skills. So what we put up, what we pony up in the competition, this is what drives me insane. $2.6 million aid package. Includes $220,000 of Pennsylvania First Grant, $42,750 in guaranteed free training grants, and a $2.3 million low interest loan. Yeah, because we want you to mechanize, so we're going to give you an interest-free loan so that you can mechanize and get rid of people. Also, they're going to get a $2.675 million tax-exempt financing thanks to the Pennsylvania Economic Development Financing Authority. And what's that? Well, that's money that we bonded out. We've taken out a bond as the state, and we're loaning it out to businesses so that the hopes that they'll bring jobs here. Problem is this place, just coming 20 miles, it's going to bring its employees with it. So I'm not getting the more jobs thing. Also, the Northampton County Industrial Development Authority, they're offering $95,000 in job creation grants. Now, the article goes into quite good detail. The company may not hire additional workers in Bethlehem. They may, but they're not committed to do so, which means they're bringing their people with them. The plant's going to cost about $7 million in capital investment. $7 million. You and me, just doing the quick math, you and me are on the hook for more than $6 million of it. That's the private sector, isn't it? That's free enterprise. That's the free market taking free money from me, you and me. Now, what I liked is the article pointed out that a big reason that they picked the area was because it was close to I-78. Again, what did I say? Location, 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 the first three things that site developers look for. Then education and infrastructure, and then cash. And since we had location, 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 they didn't really need the education because they're bringing their workers with them. Infrastructure, not such a big deal because you're close to 78, which is a great, great thing for them. But cash, lots of cash. In fact, you and I are on the hook for six of the $7 million. And somehow that's good. That's what the more jobs governor bought us. Now, think about this for a second. We're guaranteeing $6 million of the $7 million project. Curtis Wright, they're a company that had sales projected to be about $2.5 billion this year. $2.5 billion. Do you think they could have taken that $6 million and invested it for themselves? Of course they could, but why would they? Especially when we could take it from education. And just another little quick point. You know the thing in Philadelphia, where the superintendent saying, hey, we're 50 million light. We can't open the doors. Interestingly enough, Corbett said, we'll give you 45 million. You need to extract 5 million from those teachers. I've got an idea. Why don't we extract the 6 million from Curtis Wright? Leave the teachers the hell alone. Fund the education. And have a real reason for companies to come here. You know, I know it's insane. I know it's crazy. It's crazy. Why would we want to fund education? Why do we care about kids and their education? Other than the fact that that's one of the top five things that employers look for, an educated workforce. Crazy, I know. Cash. Sad stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, questions, comments. What do you think about this? Is this how we do business? Is this the best that we can do? Back after this.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see a resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
And you know, it's the sandwich comes in, you touch this, touch this, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Ho, 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 it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so. It's magic, you know.
Leave it to the Democrats to shoot themselves in the foot. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Green County Democrats decided, it'd be a good idea. It'd be funny. If we got one of those targets for the shooting range and cut out a picture of Tom Corbett's face and glued it to the target. And I'm going, really? That was dumb. And I mean, the one thing I give the crazy right-wingers credit for, when they put Obama's face on it, it's usually something, you know, kind of funny, a little creative, like a caricature kind of thing where you go, oh, you didn't just cut that out of the newspaper, did you, and glue it, did you? It seems what the Democrats in Greene County did. Oh, we're going to show them. We're going to be like Sarah Palin. Listen, dimwits, it doesn't work for you. You're supposed to be better than that. And all you did, congratulations, is give the Republicans a talking point. Give them something to change the message on. I mean, it's not bad enough that they've got a deplorable record and that what they've done should speak volumes for itself, that you had to go and give them a diversion, another talking point, a shiny thing to take off the real message, which is they've screwed this state up. Nice job. Congratulations. Works right on. Just insane. You know, it's just like, who do you put in charge of these things? I mean, instead of doing stuff, dumb stuff like that, and giving them an out, we should be talking about real things. Let's talk about the things, the policies that the Republicans have pursued that have destroyed the middle class of this country. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Mark Wayne Mullen. Love that name, Mark Wayne Mullen. Dead set against raising the minimum wage. Did a town hall meeting, asked the people, well, we can raise the minimum wage. You want to pay $20 for a hamburger? No, I want to pay $100 for a hamburger, you dimwit. The math doesn't work that way. And we've talked about this time and time again, but, you know, when you do dumb things like pasting Corbett's face to a target, it changes the message. We should be pushing for policies that make poverty better. We should be pushing for policies that grow the middle class, that grow people's opportunity to do better in our society. Instead of this low road nonsense, which is exactly what that was. And look, I understand, hey, we're going to try and rally the troops, but that's not who Democrats are. I got to be honest with you. I look at that and I go, that's just dumb. Why do it? Let's talk about things that are important. To me, the minimum wage is important. And the reason the right fights the minimum wage so vehemently is they understand the ripple effect. Sure, you're going to get those low-wage workers. You're going to bump them up I'm hoping for at least $10 an hour. But the person who is making $8, $9, $10 an hour, they're going to go up as well, which means that you're going to see people at the bottom of the economic scale and into the middle feel that ripple effect, which means they're going to have more money to spend. And, you know, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box. Understand, when people have money in their pocket, when there's a little jingling going in the pocket there, they're going to spend it. And that's going to create some economic activity. This isn't rocket science. You don't need to be a genius to figure this out. But what the right's doing, and while we've got the stupid little target, which is taking the eye off what's going on, you've got people like Bill O'Reilly out there saying, you know, those people are taking food stamps. Wow, we're encouraging them to be parasites. And, you know, there's this frame out there. There's all this waste and this fraud, this abuse. Mark Wayne, remember, talked about Mark Wayne a second ago? Mark Wayne said he was in D.C. He was going to the supermarket, and there was this couple in front of him who were physically fit. This is the quote. This was, you cannot make this up. He was in a little tank top and a pair of shorts and really nice Nike shoes. She was standing there. She was all in shape, and she looked like she had just come from a fitness program. She was in the spandex, and, you know, they were both physically fit. And they go up in front of me, and they pay with that card. Fraud. Absolute, 100%, all of it, fraud. You can't make this up. Guy was built like a brick, you know what, he said. Muscles all over. So I guess you can't be in shape and be poor. You can't be in shape and need help. You could maybe just lost a job and needed the helping hand. And this is the thing that gets me. All of this heated rhetoric, all of this animosity and divisiveness. Look, I wish Mark Wayne would go back to Congress and propose something that's going to get people back to work. I wish Mark Wayne would go back and say, hey, we need a transportation bill. I wish Mark Wayne would go back and say, hey, you know what? Let's invest in stuff and let's get people back to work. And let's be the employer of last resort. If you don't like food stamps, if you don't like it, then let's find a better solution. And for me, it's all about jobs. You want to end some of those safety net programs? Find me a jobs program. Make government the employer of last resort at and above poverty wages. That's how you turn things around. Don't just take pot shots. Don't say, oh, I know someone who told me something. That's what's infuriating to me. Because as a kid, my mother needed food stamps to feed me. And without help of our government, I wouldn't be where I am today. And paying a sight more taxes than I would like to, but than I would have had I not had that opportunity. Even that is an investment in our future. And it's something that we completely, completely forget about. I'm going to take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast or Stitcher on your smartphone. Quick break. Right back with hour 2. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced Monday that he's mandating Department of Justice reforms to some nonviolent drug offenses. In his speech before the American Bar Association, Holder said there needs to be a greater focus on treatment and less on long prison terms. Holder specifically called out the impact draconian sentencing laws have on communities and families, saying many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate this problem rather than alleviate it.
Part of Holder's plan includes not charging low-level nonviolent drug offenders in the same way as members of large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels. Holder's speech complements a push in Congress to reform sentencing. One measure in the Senate would give judges greater discretion in drug sentencing. Chicago's growing movement for social and economic justice is manifesting in broad action across a number of issues as grassroots people struggle against the corporate agenda. Doug Cunningham reports.
The people's movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is justice for working people facing foreclosure. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bankruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is and working to take back the city because it's ours.
Passengers traveling through the Vancouver International Airport over Canada's Labor Day weekend could be facing a strike line. Workers for the Airport Authority voted overwhelmingly in favor of taking job action over a push by management to implement a two-tier wage system and contract out work. The 300 workers are the backbone of the airport, and it's unclear how a strike would impact travel. The workers are represented by the Public Service Alliance of Canada and the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. A new study out by this group, Feeding America, shows that 1.89 million people in our Commonwealth, nearly one in six folks here, are at risk of hunger. And what I liked about the, you know, this is it's actually hunger. It's not this food insecurity stuff, which, you know, when I was a kid was still hungry. We've become very soft in our language. And, you know, what's frustrating me over the past couple of weeks is we've seen this assault on people who need help. You know, back when our governor was running, well, you know, those unemployed people, they're just lazy. And then it was, they can't pass a drug test. We're seeing the same kind of assault on people who need a helping hand. And I got to be honest, I'm sick of it. So when I saw this op-ed over at Penn Live this afternoon, I said, you know, I've got to get this person to come talk to us. She's written this piece, or co-authored this piece, Food Stamp Spending Benefits All Pennsylvania. We've got a link to TheRickSmithShow.com. It was written by Karen Long. She is the executive director of Feeding Pennsylvania, feedingpa.org, the website. Karen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
First, thank you for writing this. It's everything that I've been seeing in the media lately has been an assault on people who need a helping hand and people who are voiceless. So thank you for writing this.
Absolutely. You know, it's our pleasure. You know, we are serving through our food banks across the state of Pennsylvania more than 2 million people every year. You know, people who are, you know, I talk to lawmakers, I talk to people across our communities, and I say, these are our neighbors. These are the people that, you know, we live next door to, that we go to church with, that our children attend schools with. You know, it's not this class of other people. It is people that we know who need a helping hand. And those are the people who are also receiving SNAP benefits across the state.
And you mean they're not those parasites like Bill O'Reilly calls them, or you know, the really, you know, muscular, fit people who are just cheating the system, like Mark Wayne Mullen said?
Yeah, no, I would beg to disagree with that. I would say that, you know, they are, you know, parents who are working. They're the kids, you know, at our kids' schools. They're senior citizens and disabled people, I'm sure that a lot of them are physically fit. You know, we certainly don't want people to not be getting nutritionally balanced meals just because they don't have the means to afford food. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't classify them as parasites by any means.
You know, but here's the thing that bothers me, Karen, and I'm sure you've heard it. I've heard it thousands of times, this anecdotal tale of, well, I know someone, or, oh, you know, I was in line and they were buying lobster and they were buying Dom Perignon and they were driving away in a Cadillac. And I'm going, well, if that's the case, let's call and find out. Let's report them because maybe they're cheating. But it never comes to be. It's always these anecdotal tales of, I know somebody.
You're absolutely right, and we hear them all the time, too. And I have to say that's just not what we see reflected at our food banks across the state. We see low-income people coming to us, you know, in need of assistance, and they're people who never thought that they would be coming for assistance. People, you know, across the state who may have been living a comfortable middle-class life, who, you know, were one paycheck away from needing assistance. People, you know, who formerly had jobs and are now finding themselves looking for reemployment. You know, a lot of senior citizens across the state, a lot of children, a lot of disabled people. You know, it's not those people. It's, you know, the people that we see are people who genuinely need help. And, you know, realistically, when I hear these stories about people abusing the program in supermarkets, we know that, you know, every new person who comes on the program is on the SNAP benefit program for about 8 months. So people certainly aren't looking at it as a way of life. They're looking at it, you know, as a hand, you know, a helping hand to give them, you know, a hand until they can get back on their feet.
But Karen, I keep hearing that, you know, there are people who are, their whole lives they're collecting food stamps. You know, they base their lifestyle on that check at the first of the month. That's the frame that I keep getting. You're telling me eight months?
Yeah, for every new person who comes on the program, they're on an average of about 8 months. That's not to say that there aren't people who are on the program longer. But, you know, again, you're talking about a large proportion. You're talking about 3/4 of people on the program are households with children, with a senior citizen, or people who are disabled. You know, we're certainly not looking at senior citizens who have worked their entire lives and retired only to find themselves not able to make ends meet, you know, trying to, you know, go back and, you know, find jobs. And so, you know, you are talking about senior citizens who are in the program longer. Certainly, you know, a lot of disabled individuals who aren't able to work are receiving benefits. Children, you know, we're not expecting children to go out and work. But, you know, the reality of the fact is that most people on SNAP who are able to work are. And for those who aren't working, it's not for lack of wanting a job. It's this economy and the fact that they can't find a job.
So let me ask you, because, you know, there's an image that the mainstream media, I would have to think that they do it on purpose. The face of someone who's collecting SNAP benefits, the mainstream media, in my opinion, seems to focus on it as urban folks. And I remember the 2012 election, you know, both Romney and Ryan afterwards said that Obama won because, you know, he catered to the urbans. To me, that's mostly code words for minorities. Are they the face of, are they the majority of the face of people who receive SNAP benefits?
No, by far they're not. You know, when we talk about poverty and hunger in this country, every single congressional district, every single county across the country is impacted by hunger. So you're talking about counties, you know, who may have predominant numbers of racial minorities, but you're also talking about counties that are predominantly Caucasian. You're talking about rural communities and you're talking about urban communities. Across Pennsylvania, when I look at the top 5 states that are, you know, food insecure, as USDA calls them, I just like to call them hungry.
Yes.
You know, certainly Philadelphia is one of those top 5 counties, but the other 4 are more suburban and rural communities. So, you know, there certainly is this, you know, this misperception out there that, you know, the people who are on SNAP benefits, that it's all minorities, it's people who don't want to work, it's people who are living off the dole and living off the system. But realistically, that's just not true.
Yeah, and some of the reading that I've done, you know, the face of people who are collecting SNAP benefits are people like my mother, white single women who are mothers who have children and families to support, and the wages that they earn just don't keep up.
That's absolutely true. You know, we see a lot of, you know, families, single mothers who are on this program. We actually see a lot of senior citizens now who, you know, because of, you know, the economy and the times are, you know, raising their grandchildren. And so, you know, these are senior citizens who are on the program as well. It's, you know, there is this myth that I think has been perpetuated ever since the Reagan administration of, you know, the welfare queen and her Cadillac pulling up to the grocery store. It's just that. It's a myth. It's not the reality of what we're seeing out there every day at the supermarkets. It's not the reality of the people that we see coming to our food banks every day for assistance.
Now, I agree with you, but we do have welfare queens in this country. The problem is you and I never run into them. They're the folks who sit in our corporate boardrooms and the big agribusinesses. What was it? 4% of agribusiness sucks up, what, 74% of all of the farm bill money that goes to them? Just a handful of these companies. Those are the welfare queens. And when you've got a Congress who says, we're going to fund those welfare queens, but actual hungry children and seniors and mothers trying to raise, no, you, too bad for you.
Well, and the interesting part is, you know, when we talk about the farm bill, we hear about the fact that, you know, more than three quarters of the spending is going to nutrition assistance programs. And while that may be true, when you look at that spending, a quarter of that spending has actually gone back to the agricultural economy. And, you know, when I think about that, you know, there are benefits. Pennsylvania, you know, our number one economy is agriculture. And, you know, if we can provide additional benefits to support Pennsylvania's small farmers and agricultural interests, more power to them. But I think that we shouldn't overlook the fact that this program isn't just feeding low-income people. It's supporting, you know, our agricultural economy in Pennsylvania. It's supporting our economy as a whole.
Yeah, it's an economic driver. In fact, you know, there's some statistics around for every dollar in SNAP benefits that go out, it generates a pretty sizable wallop of economic activity as well.
Yeah, we actually know, according to Moody's Economics and USDA, that for every dollar in SNAP spending, it generates $1.79 in economic activity. So we're talking about that. We're talking about, you know, people who are receiving SNAP benefits are going to the grocery store. They're purchasing food. They're supporting jobs of the workers at that grocery store. They're supporting the transportation infrastructure that got the food to that store. They're supporting the agricultural interests to grew that food. They're supporting the food manufacturers who produce and manufacture that food. So it's a huge economic driver, especially in a state like Pennsylvania, where, you know, the food and agricultural industry is such a big economic driver.
So what happens if we pull that money out? And, you know, we hear a lot about austerity, and you look across at Europe where they've been practicing this austerity for probably 20 years now. Hasn't worked. So pulling this money back, I don't see how the savings from literally taking food out of the mouths of children is going to help us recover or make them any more likely to go out and work harder or get a job when the jobs aren't there.
I would agree with that. I think, you know, part of the attack on the program from the U.S. House of Representatives has been that, you know, we need to get people back to work, and we can't be giving SNAP benefits to people who don't have jobs. The reality is that a lot of people who don't have jobs, you know, it's not that they're not looking for jobs. They're seeking jobs. The jobs aren't there. You know, we've had a lot of people who've lost their jobs due to the Great Recession. A lot of people who may be reemployed, but, you know, they're working part-time jobs. They're working for lower wages, and they just simply don't have enough money to make ends meet. Yet there's this proposal out there that says that, you know, we're going to require people to have jobs, and that, you know, the states are going to lose their option to have this waiver to cover people, you know, during times of high unemployment who don't have jobs. And, you know, the kicker is that the states are going to be able to keep any money that they save as a result of kicking people off this program.
You know what I love? I love the people who tell me they believe in less intrusive federal government. They believe in states' rights. But then they come up with mandates like that says, well, we're going to not let you do what you think is best for your states and for your citizens. That always cracks me up.
Absolutely agree. I think, you know, right now, when you go back and look at welfare reform in the mid-90s, they instituted a rule then that said that any able-bodied childless adults could only receive SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits, for 3 months out of every 36-month period. But at that point, at least, you know, they had the foresight to include a provision saying that states could ask for a waiver during times of high unemployment. What the House of Representatives right now is proposing is to eliminate the option to have that waiver and to say that, you know, able-bodied adults either need to be working at least 20 hours a week, be participating in some type of job placement or job training program, or they're going to be restricted to benefits 3 months out of every 36. The problem is that there's no funding for these states to be able to actually implement job training programs. So, you know, if you're doing everything you can to look for a job and you can't find employment after your 3 months, you're off the program. And our major concern, Feeding Pennsylvania represents the 9 Feeding America food banks serving the state of Pennsylvania. Again, we're serving, you know, more than 2 million people every year. About half of our recipients are already receiving food stamp benefits, but those benefits don't last them through the month. If you're looking at any of these proposals that are out there in Congress right now, you're talking about cutting millions of people off of the program. Those people aren't going to cease to be hungry just because they're not on the program. They're going to be coming to our food banks at a time when our food banks are strapped and we can barely provide food to those people coming to us. So, you know, I'm not sure what the recourse is going to be when we're, you know, when we're faced with an additional, you know, several million people coming to us on a daily basis.
Excellent point. Let me ask you last line of questioning. You know, we keep hearing from the political right more than anything that government shouldn't be doing this. All of these programs, the social safety net should be done by charity. It should be churches or the benevolence of the wealth class in our country. It should all be charity, and the local, state, federal government should have no role in it whatsoever. Is it possible for charity to take on the burden that we're seeing, and or even in good times, is it possible for charity alone to do this?
It is absolutely impossible for charity to take on this burden. You know, I'm sure all of us who work in the charitable sector wish it were possible, but we know it's not. Charity is providing about 4% of all of the food assistance throughout the country. You know, we like to think of ourselves as a good model of the private public charitable partnership, but we rely on you know, the private sector to provide us with donations of financial donations, food donations. We rely on the public sector to provide funding both at the federal and state level. You know, it's a system, and working together we can help to provide food to those in need. But if all of those funds were cut, there is no way that the charitable system could step up and provide the food to, you know, you're talking about more than 50 million people in this country who are at risk of hunger.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that's always kind of left me scratching my head. And I've always said if charity could have done it, they would have from the beginning. We have these programs for a reason, because charity couldn't do it. The need was that great. And even in good times, I do believe, is that great. An excellent article. I appreciate it. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. The article called Food Stamp Spending Benefits All Pennsylvanians, written by Carolyn Long and David McCorkle. Of course, Carolyn is the executive director of Feeding Pennsylvania, feedingpa.org, the website. Carolyn, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Great to talk with you too, Rick. Thanks so much.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public, as well as with co-workers, are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover. For staying home means a loss of pay, or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable and, since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only failed to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying, all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So the New York Times had an interesting editorial piece today that caught my attention. This idea that, and we've talked about this on the state level, you got people like Daryl Metcalf who believe government should be the leader in the race to the bottom. They should be going getting the cheapest contracting, slashing wages, and you know, everything that you can possibly do to pull the economy down. Instead of saying, you know what, if we're going to use taxpayer dollars, it should be propping us up. It should be making us better off. It should be good for society as a whole. A high road economy, a high wage economy. Take just a thought. Which is why I'm in favor of prevailing wage laws that say, you know what, if you're doing a job, you can at least pay what the local prevailing wage is. We're not going to pull things down. And I look at this editorial piece who pointed out that Johnson, when President Johnson was in office in 65, he made an executive order mandating that all government contracts have non-discrimination clauses in it. You can't discriminate against blacks or Hispanics or anyone else, or whites or anybody. Best person gets the job. He used the executive order to do that. What the editorial board is saying is that Obama should be using his executive order power to say, you know what, any federal contracts, any government contracts that go out are going to have a standard wage. You want to talk about a quick stimulus? Get all of those people, because as it turns out, government is the largest employer of these contractors. And if you were to raise their wage up, it would help. It would help stimulate the economy. And what they write is the executive order aimed at raising the pay of millions of poorly paid employees of the government contractors. They say recent studies have shown how hundreds of billions of dollars in federal contracts, grants, loans, concessions, and property leases currently flow to companies that pay low wages and provide few, if any, benefits, even as executive pay among federal contractors has risen. They point out, in effect, tax dollars are being used to fuel the low-wage economy, and in the process, worsen inequality. They go on to say that many laws and executive actions mostly in the 30s through the 60s, require fair pay for employees of federal contractors. They say, but over time, here it comes, Reagan years, you know, going forward, over time those provisions have been eroded by special interest exemptions, complex contracting processes, and lax enforcement. They say that a new executive order could ensure that the awarding of contracts is based on the quality of jobs created, challenging the notion that the best contractor is the one with the lowest labor costs. This is an editorial board writing this. They write, Mr. Obama could also could tell federal agencies to conduct reviews of contracts to see if the work should be done in-house. Here's the kicker to that. There is compelling evidence, they write, that using private sector contractors is often costlier than using government employees, even when contractors pay workers little. I've been saying this for years. And in fact, I go back to when we were in Wisconsin. And I've told this story a number of times, and I'll probably tell it a million times more, because I'm still struck by it. While there are people sleeping in the Capitol over Scott Walker taking collective bargaining rights away from state workers and basically kicking them in the teeth and, you know, shedding the government of workforces, I'm standing behind a guy at the mechanic, at the auto place getting my oil changed. The guy in front of me is retiring from state work. He says that he's retiring, he's taking his pension, and he's going to work for someone, a private contractor, doing the exact same job, but making twice the wage. Without benefits, of course, but making twice the wage. And the guy behind the counter was mad that the guy got a pension. Not the fact that it was going to cost twice as much for that guy to do the same job that he was doing for the state. And the guy told him that. He said, they're privatizing this, it's going to cost twice as much. I mean, we've seen this year after year. We see this often. And for me, I got to be honest. My hope is Obama reads this and goes, you know what? I got that power. I can do it. Now, it would drive the right wing nuts. But to me, it's the right thing. I mean, we're seeing workers out in the streets saying, you know what? We work for federal contractors and we're collecting food stamps. I mean, think about this for a second. Before we go to break, think about this. So our tax dollars, come with me on this. Our tax dollars are paying for things that we used to do for ourselves, that we the people did through ourselves, through our government, hired someone to do it, paid them a reasonable living wage. We've privatized that to a private contractor who now charges us more to do it, pays the workers less, so the worker has less money to invest and pay into the economy. And they make so little that they then qualify for safety net programs like SNAP, like LIHEAP, education, school lunches, you name it. All of the stuff that comes with being a low-waged worker. I mean, not only are we paying more for the service, but we're paying more so that the worker can survive. Does that seem dumb to you? Because it seems ignorant to me. I mean, if your frame is we need to make as much money as we can for a handful of people and that we want to destroy government, yeah, that's, you're right in line. We're marching down that hallway. But if your idea is how do we get the best bang for our buck? How do we have an economy that works for all? How do we provide services for ourselves, we the people, in the most efficient, best way possible for society? Privatization is a failure. And as I've been saying for weeks, please, anybody, show me something we've privatized that's done better for you and me, for we the people, and has cost less. I can't even find things that have really been done that are better for us, let alone cheaper. But the frame is always been, in my lifetime, private is better. The free market does it better. Which is a bunch of, to use a Joe Biden word, a bunch of malarkey. And the thing is we know it. Deep down, we know it's a lie. But I guess it's just easier to believe the lie since it's been told to us so often. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back and talk about what's going on in New Jersey, evidently Cory Booker going to be the guy running, going to be the, he's going to win. Right back after this. The working class is under attack.
To the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced Monday that he's mandating Department of Justice reforms to some nonviolent drug offenses. In his speech before the American Bar Association, Holder said there needs to be a greater focus on treatment and less on long prison terms. Holder specifically called out the impact draconian sentencing laws have on communities and families, saying many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate this problem rather than alleviate it. Part of Holder's plan includes not charging low-level nonviolent drug offenders in the same way as members of large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels. Holder's speech complements a push in Congress to reform sentencing. One measure in the Senate would give judges greater discretion in drug sentencing. Chicago's growing movement for social and economic justice is manifesting in broad action across a number of issues as grassroots people struggle against the corporate agenda. Doug Cunningham reports.
The people's movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is justice for working people facing foreclosure. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bank Disruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is and working to take back the city because it's ours.
Passengers traveling through the Vancouver International Airport over Canada's Labor Day weekend could be facing a strike line. Workers for the Airport Authority voted overwhelmingly in favor of taking job action over a push by management to implement a two-tier wage system and contract out work. The 300 workers are the backbone of the airport, and it's unclear how a strike would impact travel. The workers are represented by the Public Service Alliance of Canada and the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What they do, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Yeah, they believe in teachers when they can pay them nothing. Yeah, that's when they believe in. Oh, and I remember a friend of mine who told me when she started teaching, you know, they didn't have teachers' unions back then. And she's in her 70s. She said, you know, back then, you know, we needed the apple. When little Susie or Johnny brought us the apple, that was our lunch because we were paid so poorly. But as soon as we, and people loved us, but as soon as we wanted to buy our own apple or maybe, who knows, maybe a pear, that's when the wealth class turned. And that's the beginning of the demonizing of teachers that people like Christie and the right have gone. And look, a good number of Democrats as well. And I look at what went on in New Jersey tonight. Wall Street got their man. Cory Booker won the Democratic primary. What's that going to mean? Well, let's find out. I've got Jersey Jasmine on the phone. His website, jerseyjasmine.blogspot.com. Jersey, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure to be here.
So Walmart, Wall Street got their guy. What's that going to mean?
Boy, they sure did, didn't they? You know, I think we have to preface anything, Rick, by saying this. The thought of, for me, getting another Republican in the Senate is so horrible that I am willing to go shopping right now for clothespins to get the right size to put on my nose in October, because I can't imagine putting Steve Lonergan, who is, you know, let's be gracious about this, who is a little less than he should be in terms of his qualifications to serve in the Senate, and is maybe a little bit to the right. Oh, well, please. He's way to the right of what, say, New Jerseyans think. The thought of putting that guy into the Senate is absolutely abhorrent. So Cory is, he's going to get people like me, but we're not going to go in happy.
You're not voting for Cory Booker. You're voting against the other guy.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's absolutely right. And say, too, it's not all bad. I mean, he's going to make sure that we don't get another wacko on the Supreme Court. You know, he is on the right side of some good social issues. So I don't want to paint this guy as being, you know, exactly the same as a Tea Partier. He's not. But there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt. He is a corporatist. He does represent this wing of the Democratic Party that has really been a thorn in the side of working people, and particularly unions, and especially on education, the sort of things that he has been promoting, the sort of things that he has been about, are very dangerous, not just for working people, not just for teachers, but for the kids. And, in fact, one of the great untold stories about Cory Booker is that if he could have run again in Newark, I don't think he would have won. I think the people of – now, I don't live in Newark. I can't speak for everybody there, but I can go on what I see. I can go on what's been happening over the last year. There was a massive student protest, a massive student walkout this past spring because of the disenchantment with cuts. Parents have filed a civil rights lawsuit, and in fact, the Justice Department has said that there is enough evidence there to investigate because the cuts to schools are so weighted against minorities and so weighted against the poor. The teachers have been up in arms, and the AFT leader, Joe Del Grosso, who actually has worked with Booker and Anderson on Candy Anderson, the state superintendent, on several things, he stood up and demanded an audit of the school district, which, of course, is run by the state. So over and over again, you're hearing from the people of Newark that super mayor, it's kind of nice that he goes out and he shovels out your car, or he rescues your cat from a burning building, or whatever, you know, stunt he's got going on lately. But in terms of representing their interests, I think the people of Newark have started to say, you know, enough's enough. So, you know, it's not like he's going to ride in on a big tide of support from his own home base. And it's turning out that his home base, in fact, is not in Newark. It's probably down on Wall Street.
The money helps, I guess. And you look at the big names that he brought in and the big money that he pulled in. And to me, immediately, that throws up major red flags when you're talking about that kind of money that he pulled in.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, this all started with the Zuckerberg money. For those of your listeners who don't know, Mark Zuckerberg, of course, from Facebook, was a big show of $100 million. And they announced it on Oprah, and, you know, Chris Christie was there. It was a very big deal. And when you ask the people of Newark, have you seen this money? They really haven't. A lot of it's gone to contractors. A lot of it's gone to consultants, to people who are sort of entrenched in the Democratic Party. People like Bradley Tusk have been getting, you know, their share of it. And then a big part of it went to a merit pay contract, which has caused a lot of consternation with the teachers union. And, in fact, we're seeing something similar to what's happened in Chicago and New York, and I think in Washington, D.C., where there has been some disaffection of the members of the local, and they sort of banded together and have put together sort of a rival faction. That, of course, is how Karen Lewis rose to become the president of the Chicago Teachers Union, and we see that with the Moore Coalition in New York. There's a group called the New Caucus, and they actually won a majority of seats on the local union's representation board. And really, that's come about because many of the teachers feel like they haven't been the teachers union has not been standing up strongly enough to the state control, and that Cory Booker has sort of been allowing this all to happen. So, you know, that money has not come without a political price at home for Cory Booker. One of the big funders for him, though, and one of the ones who I'm really surprised that this has not gotten a lot of play is the Tisch family. And they're, of course, very wealthy people in New York. Andrew Tisch is, among other things, on the board of K-12 Inc. And I know you know them very well because of all the nonsense that's happened with cyber charters
yep.
in Pennsylvania. Well, K-12 is one of the biggest players in this game. And in his last mayoral campaign, no one gave more money to Cory Booker than the Tisch family. And in fact, Andrew Tisch was a huge supporter of his. So if that's an indication of where Booker's, where his interests lie, we're going to be in for some really interesting things and, unfortunately, some dangerous things, coming out from his, term in the Senate on education. Seeing virtual schools proliferate is not something that anybody should want. And again, you know, all we have to do is look over on your side of the Delaware for proof of that.
Yeah, I mean, K-12, they advertise everywhere.
Yeah, they advertise on my blog. I turn it on sometimes, and there's an ad from K-12, and no one's been a bigger questioner of them for me. But, yeah, they're throwing around a lot of money, throwing it around in state houses, and again, Cory Booker is certainly going to be their guy, in spite of the fact that there really is no evidence that this sort of thing works. That's another thing about education in Newark. Newark has really become a laboratory for charter schools, and we are seeing more and more indication when you really look at the data. And I would recommend anybody follow the blog of Professor Bruce Baker, his professor at Rutgers, who I quote quite frequently. He's looked very carefully at this. These charter schools are essentially segregating the city. The kids who are going to the charter schools, far less likely to have special education needs, far less likely to speak a language other than English at home, far more likely to not be in the deep poverty that we see in many parts of Newark, and far more likely to leave rather than see their whole careers work their way through. In fact, I just did a post the other day about uncommon schools. There's a school here called North Star Academy, and they had an attrition rate from fifth grade to their senior year in a couple of classes that was better than 75%.
Wow.
So one in four chance you're going to make it through. And I said on the blog post, that actually is a worse attrition rate than for the Navy SEAL. And that, I'm sorry, I have to clarify, that's just for black males, black boys in Newark. So you have a better chance of making it through Navy SEAL training than you do making it through this particular charter school in Newark if you happen to be a black boy. That's scary. Again, Booker has been the one who's sort of acquiesced to this, set up this atmosphere, and it's not something that I would say a lot of people in Newark would say is serving their children very well.
Yeah, but I keep asking the question, you know, why? Why is it that you know, someone like Booker would get behind that, other than the money? I mean, the money obviously is the big, in my mind the big driving factor, but is it that they not see the research that's out there? And there's a lot of research now. I mean, we've had years of it, the Stanford thing. It's just not working.
Yeah, I'd like to believe. I mean, it would be easy to say that it's always about people making profit, and there's no question. There are people out there who are making profits. You know, our good buddy Vahan Gheorghe, he's coming to Camden, by the way. The guy down in Chester,
right,
who's been making money hand and fist.
Yep.
Just got approved, coming to Camden. It's the last thing that we need here. Not everybody in the charter sector is like that, though. I do believe that a lot of this is ideological, and I do think that Cory Booker sort of buys into that particular mindset. He's around those people. He likes those people. We had this whole story this week about his own internet startup, and the son of Jeff Zucker, who is the president of CNN, kid's 15 years old and is on his board of directors. You know, what does that tell you? There's a mindset there that says that, you know, we belong to this club. We should be running things. Let us take control of it. And if we happen to make some money along the way, all that much the better. What I think a lot of people in Newark are beginning to stand up and demand, and I really think the next mayoral race, the race to replace him, is going to be about this. Should these cities be taking control of themselves? Should the people who actually live there be the ones who make the decisions about how their schools are run, about how they want their kids to receive their education? Newark, I think now it's 18 years, has been under state control, and Cory Booker's been fine with it. He doesn't have a problem with giving the control of the schools of New Jersey over to Chris Christie. He and Christie, they don't agree on everything, but on many things, they're soulmates. And I do think there is that similarity there, Rick, in this idea of believing that there is an ideological predilection toward the market, toward this sort of elite class kind of making the decisions for everyone else. And Cory Booker seems to, unfortunately, fall into that. Again, it doesn't augur well for his Senate career, but I think we all knew that this was coming, and tonight is certainly not a surprise to anybody who watches New Jersey politics.
Yeah, not really, in my view, not really a night to be celebrating. Any last question? Any chance he loses in the general?
What's the old saying? If they catch him in bed with a dead woman or a live boy,
yeah.
I mean, look, he had a couple. He didn't have a very good week. He had this whole thing with Waywire, where it came out about this tech company, and he hasn't really disclosed a lot. It turns out that he was getting payments from his old law firm. You remember back in the day, Dick Cheney was getting that from Halliburton.
Yep.
He was getting deferred payments. Sounds like almost exactly the same thing. We don't know how much it is. So, he has not been fully vetted. And this, you got to give Chris Christie credit. This is part of the genius of Chris Christie and this ridiculous election. He managed to work it out so that we took our focus away from his own race this summer. We put it on Cory Booker, and the primary was short enough that he didn't really get vetted. And, the election's only in October. I don't think we're going to see any major things happen. And in that case, again, Steve Lonergan is so far to the right. He's such a Tea Partier. Most New Jerseyans are just going to roll their eyes. And like I said, I'm going to go into that booth. I will pull the lever for Booker. He's not going to have my support. But already we've got people in the state who are saying who's going to run against him in the next primary.
Wow.
Bob Braun, very influential columnist for years at the Star Ledger, just recently retired, doing his own blog, and he was a assistant to Rush Holt, but Braun has already come out and said somebody else has got to step up and go up against Cory Booker he's just not acceptable to the mainstream of the Democratic Party here in New Jersey. I don't know if anybody is going to take him on. It's a monumental task. It may be political suicide if you're a Democrat to do that, but there are enough people who have enough questions about Booker. It's possible. But again, barring any huge scandal, I just don't see any way that this guy is not the next senator from New Jersey.
Yeah, as I said today, I blame Lautenberg for all this. And you know, my buddy goes, you know, you can't blame a dead guy.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. Arrogance of being in the Senate all that time. Arrogance.
It's, you know, and then you remember how he got back there with the whole thing with Torricelli and you know, the Torricelli pulling out at the last minute. It's New Jersey Democratic politics is, it's all about the machine.
Yep.
And there are a couple big machines here, and they sort of jockey for position, and everybody sort of understands their role. Everybody understands their assignment. But, you know, there are those of us who are, you know, in the teachers and in the labor movement and environmentalists, people who are worried about women's rights, people who are fighting for marriage equity. We're kind of looking at the Democratic machine here and saying, you know, where is our representation? Where is our voice? Because increasingly we're finding we're not getting it. Again, we're going to get some good stuff out of Cory Booker. I cannot sit here, Rick, and pretend that this is all bad. It's
right.
Not all bad.
No, I'm not saying it is, but the things that I think are important, the education to me, is a huge thing.
Without question, and on that, unfortunately, the man is just not on the right side of the things. I mean, he's even so far gone that he's for vouchers, which is just, you know, you can't get more right-wing than that on education. Not even Barack Obama and Arne Duncan are for vouchers, but Booker has been big on this. Part of that is sort of paying respect to this group of influential black ministers who have been pushing for this for a long time. Part of it is about getting votes in Lakewood, New Jersey, big Hasidic and Orthodox Jewish community looking to get vouchers so that they get money back for kids who are already attending yeshivas, so there's definitely a political component to it. But is it the right thing for New Jersey's kids? No.
It's not the right thing for anybody's kids, Jersey.
Yeah, and especially, again, as a senator, he will have some say about that, from what I understand, in terms of Washington, D.C. That's the last thing that the Washington school system needs right now is to start getting vouchers in there. That's already a system that is being starved for funds. The last thing that they need is to expand those programs. And we've seen what it's done in places like Milwaukee. It's, it's so pernicious and it's so dangerous. And unfortunately, I don't see Booker at this point being open to hearing the other side of this. And actually, I must say, you ask a very good question. We know what the research is. Why isn't he listening to it? You know what? Why isn't he actually listening to what experts have to say, what the research has to say?
We shall see. We'll see how this turns out. I mean,
yeah.
Like you said, it's not all bad, but a good portion of it. Jersey Jasmine, appreciate the time. Again, the website, jerseyjasmine.blogspot.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Real good stuff there. Thanks so much. It's great talking with you, man.
It's always great to talk with you, Rick. Keep on keeping up.
Come back sooner.
Anytime.
All righty.
Anytime I don't have class today.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, man.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want.
PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public, as well as with co-workers, are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover. For staying home means a loss of pay, or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable and, since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But, au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only fail to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying, all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In Tony Bennett's fabric, I have an addiction to really pushing ed reform policy. I sometimes refer to it as my drug of choice.
But most of all, it's not fair to the children of Florida that I continue as commissioner.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one
goes. You know, I got to be honest, all of these quote-unquote reformers of education, you know, I got to be honest, it's all about destroying public education. And it's sad for me because, you know, Booker is one of those guys who's, like Jersey said, is pushing this poison. And the thing is that gets me is, you know, he got more than 60% of the vote. Representative Frank Pallone got about 20%. Representative Holt finished third with about 15%. And State Assembly Speaker Sheila Oliver got less than 5%. And, you know, you look at this and you go, you know, it's still going to be a Democrat sitting in the seat. They're still going to have a potential, you know, to hold that. But, you know, is this the kind of Democrat we want? You know, this is why people ask me, you're a Democrat, right? Well, not necessarily. There are a lot of them not too thrilled with. Sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. You can also download it on your smartphone at Stitcher. That's always there. And as always, you can always email me, Rick@RickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. Stick around.
90% of the world. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the world.
We're smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced Monday that he's mandating Department of Justice reforms to some nonviolent drug offenses. In his speech before the American Bar Association, Holder said there needs to be a greater focus on treatment and less on long prison terms. Holder specifically called out the impact draconian sentencing laws have on communities and families, saying many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate this problem rather than alleviate it. Part of Holder's plan includes not charging low-level nonviolent drug offenders in the same way as members of large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels. Holder's speech complements a push in Congress to reform sentencing. One measure in the Senate would give judges greater discretion in drug sentencing. Chicago's growing movement for social and economic justice is manifesting in broad action across a number of issues as grassroots people struggle against the corporate agenda. Doug Cunningham reports.
The people's movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is justice for working people facing foreclosure. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bank Disruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is and working to take back the city because it's ours.
Passengers traveling through the Vancouver International Airport over Canada's Labor Day weekend could be facing a strike line. Workers for the Airport Authority voted overwhelmingly in favor of taking job action over a push by management to implement a two-tier wage system and contract out work. The 300 workers are the backbone of the airport, and it's unclear how a strike would impact travel. The workers are represented by the Public Service Alliance of Canada and the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees.
Workers' Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, for bosses knew would leave. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did folk become on my governor's says?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You know, that's, you know, spot on. The only belt that seems to be tightening are those of the people who are working for a living, trying to make ends meet. And, you know, the finger seems to be always pointed at the teachers and at the public sector workers. And I look at what's going on in Philadelphia right now. And, you know, to be honest, I give the superintendent credit. You know, say, look, we don't have the resources to open the school. We need more. And you look what our governor did. We'll give you some of it, but you've got to get something from those teachers. To me, that one of those extremely Machiavellian moves. It just is what it is. Very divisive and sad stuff. But I look here in Harrisburg, where the school district, the chief recovery officer, is saying, you know what, you take the contract, or we're going to be laying off 15 people, while simultaneously hiring a charter school director. Or a cyber director? Here to talk a little bit about what this is all about is Mary Schwanger. She's the director of AFSCME District Council 90, representing some of the members here. Mary, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, hi, Rick. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Am I getting this right? You take what we're offering, you take the pay cut, you take the increase in health care, or we're going to fire a bunch of your people, and then we're going to use that money that you give up to hire a cyber person?
Well, there's that, yes. And then in addition to that, we're being told that if we don't agree to this, that they will then begin to contract out all our work.
So if you don't take it, we're gonna be union busters then.
Yes. Well, that's what it feels like, absolutely.
Now, as I understand this, and you know, as I'm looking at this, we're talking about, you know, this has been something that's been going on for a while, that teachers have taken concessions, that workers have taken across the spectrum, and it just seems to me like it's a bleeding of more. How much more can we soak out of you? That really, I think, comes from the state level. You look at our governor and the Republicans in the General Assembly. By defunding the local school districts, it's really their attack on you guys, isn't it?
It is, and we're seeing it in school district after school district. Harrisburg isn't the only school district. It's just that because we're in that recovery status, we even have less ability to bargain in this case. And it's sad because these workers have not had a raise in 3 years, and now they're asking us to take a 5% cut. Plus, we contribute to health care, 1.5% of base pay, but they're saying because this is a recovery plan, we must contribute 5% of premium on top of that. And, you know, we just don't think that's fair for our, you know, our bargaining unit. They're, you know, they're not the highest paid people in the district, obviously, and we believe that the fair way is for them to pay a percent of their salary rather than a percent of premium. We have a lot of single heads of household parents who just can't afford family coverage.
Explain what that means, because, well, you know, I think people can get kind of confused about what you're talking about. Explain how that would work out. Let's say you make $30,000 a year. Explain what you mean by the two differences.
Well, currently we pay a percent of their base salary towards the health care. So if you make less, you contribute less. If you make more, you contribute more. And that's the way we do it at the Commonwealth, and that's the way we think is the fair way. But because of this recovery plan, the chief recovery officer is telling us we can't deviate from that, that we have to – the plan says that everyone has to contribute 5% of premium. So a single parent – that has one child is now going to have to pay for family coverage and pay 5% of that high premium when they wouldn't necessarily be paying that much.
Somebody who
makes more would be paying more.
That sounds to me to be a huge increase. I mean, going from paying a percentage of your salary to a percentage of the actual cost of the health, that could be a massive jump.
Yes, it is. It is. And that's why I think we've had some difficulty getting this ratified. But unfortunately, the teachers have ratified it, and they're the largest bargaining unit. So, it's a one-year contract, and our members are not happy about this.
No, I can't imagine. As you've said, it's been 3 years since they've gotten a raise, and
right.
and the reality is that the cost of everything continues to go up. How are you going to keep and attract the best people to do these jobs if they can't make ends meet at home?
Yeah, you're not going to be able to, and that's why they're threatening contracting out, because they'll bring in very low-paid workers with probably no health care, probably people who have their children on the CHIPS plan. It's very frustrating. It's just very frustrating for our workers.
How much of this is the responsibility of the recovery officer, this Gino Vino, and how much of it is the responsibility of the state? I mean, I've, uh, I, I'm, I look at the state level and the, you know, what, $3 billion they've taken from education over the last 3 years. I think that has a big part of this, right?
It is a very big part of it because, like I said, we're seeing this in every school district, you know, and not just school districts that are inner city schools that have a difficult time, especially in the capital city, raising revenue. But we're seeing it in wealthy school districts also, where we represent support staff. And it's, you know, it is difficult because Harrisburg formerly got a fairly decent portion of state aid to the school district in the past, and we're just not seeing it, and that's why we're in recovery. And that's and the other really frustrating issue is that most of our members live in the city too, so their taxes are going up in addition to this.
Yeah.
And I don't think you have that with the other bargaining unit, with it, you know.
And one of the things that just drives me nuts is then you see this, that they're doing this, and on top of it, they go, well, we need to hire a cyber charter director and
right.
a salary in excess of $100,000. And I'm going, wait a second. I've read the studies. I'm sorry. The cyber charter stuff, it ain't working. We're spending a ton of money. Basically, we're just throwing it in a hole, as far as I'm concerned, because I've read the studies; they don't work. Here in the Commonwealth, well, there's 16 cyber charter schools. None of them made AYP. It seems to me that we're throwing good money after bad when we could be using that money to resource our public schools.
Absolutely, and the sad part about it is the money constantly gets drained out of city schools. You know, they're the target. You don't see it as much in rural schools, but they don't work. They absolutely don't work. And it's just draining money out of the school districts. And it's just frustrating.
You know, I was reading the One Penn Live article, and they pointed out that there's this plan that the district has that's going to allocate $1.28 million to expand these cyber charter schools. And I'm going, you know, that's almost $1.3 million that could be much better spent somewhere else. But instead, we're pushing the snake oil. We're pushing stuff we know doesn't work.
And yet, Gene Vino has said publicly that part of the reason why the school district is in this hole is because of the money that's being drained out of the district by charter schools.
So
he knows
why,
it's a problem.
So why isn't he pushing against that? I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, if you know that's a problem, and in the article he said, well, you know, how did he put it? Becoming a district that offers many types of products for this community, and one of them is blended cyber program. Education is not a product. I'm sorry, I'm losing this corporate mentality that it's a commodity that we're making products out of. No, it's our kids' future.
Right.
So what can we do to help? How do people push back against this? Because I know there are a lot of people going, it's insane. You're going to be stealing money from workers and creating a position for a director of cyber charter schools that we know doesn't work. I know a lot of people feel helpless. What do we do?
Well, I think we need a new governor. That's
a start. In fact, I was down in York this evening for the opening of Tom Wolf's his campaign office there in York. You know, one of the guys running, and at this point, anybody on the list so far that I'd take over the guy sitting in the governor's mansion.
Absolutely, because I worry that 4 more years of this governor will destroy our public education system.
And 4 more years of a control by the Republicans in the House and in the Senate. I mean, the radicals that have taken over the Republican Party need to be expelled. And listen, Republicans, take your party back. There's a segment that is destroying not only your party, but our Commonwealth.
Right.
It's just that simple to me. So that's it. We need to get rid of the governor. Get rid of the
Yes. And I think working people need to get involved in government at the local level.
Yes.
I think that's the other thing that needs to happen, that we need to hear more from working people at school districts and townships and boroughs today, because we have to speak up. This can't continue. People need to make a living wage, and they need to have health care.
Yep, absolutely. You know, the lastly, you know, one of the things that that I heard on the radio, you know, pimping the you know, the charters and the profiteered schools, is that, you know, in the future you won't have to worry about, don't worry about those school boards. You know, you come to our school, you won't have to worry about that. Don't worry about being involved. We'll take care of it. We'll go from there. don't worry your little heads. So
right.
There's a point down the road, Mary, that I truly believe we're going to lose our voice if we don't do it right now.
Right. I think that, too. And these are our communities, and we need to take them back.
I'm with you. Mary Schwanger, I appreciate the time. Director of District Council 90, AFSCME. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Desperate measures we explore, marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, even their lovers all they hate. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have flipped into a cap.
That we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer.
One day longer.
The people's voice is stronger.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public as well as with co-workers are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover. For staying home means a loss of pay or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable, and since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But, au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only failed to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying, all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This assault on workers has been going on for so long that I think most of us have just thought, well, you know, this is how it's always been. The misclassification, the wage theft, you name it. And I look to New York, and I thought there was a brief moment in time where New York was going to pass a law that would correct some of the misclassification going on. Well, yesterday the New York Post reported that Albany, there in New York, the capital, has passed a Fair Play Act, which was supposed to say, you know what, if you work for a company, you should be considered an employee. If you're doing work for that company and it meets certain criteria, you should be an employee. This independent contractor thing, not working. And the target really has been, and the target company that people look at when they look at employee misclassification, to me, immediately is FedEx. I mean, you see all these guys running around in the purple and black outfits, driving the big truck with the huge FedEx on the side of it. You think that those people work for FedEx. They don't. Very, very few actually work for FedEx. They've set their model up on independent contractors. What they do is they sell these routes to somebody who then hires a couple of people that then go run these routes for them for FedEx. And those people on the trucks, they're independent contractors. Now, they may work for this, you know, this independent contractor. However, they set their agreement up. But most of them, it's a piece rate deal. You're on your own. You're a small business person. You're your own boss. That's it. You're your own boss. But the problem with that is, then they don't pay Social Security tax. They don't pay unemployment. They'll pay local taxes. They don't pay any of that stuff as an employer would do, which gives them a competitive advantage over their competitors. I thought New York was going to pass something. It was in the act. It was in the move. The bill was there. There was support for it. Cuomo was expected to sign it. Then comes a strange legislation twist. On the last day of the session in June, the bill was changed. Just a little change. Language, little bit of language. The Fair Pay Act now would require now workers who take work directions from a company, dress in a company uniform, and work solely for that company to be considered employees, according to the Daily Post. But crafted into the final version of the bill is an exception for companies that pay an independent operator that buys its own routes and then purchases or leases its own trucks and hires workers. What did I just lay out? Oh, yeah, the FedEx model. And you got to wonder, you know, how much money did they spend lobbying? How much money? According to reports, because of this little change in language, FedEx is going to save about $35,000 per year per employee by obviously not paying Social Security tax, by not having vehicle repairs, unemployment, overtime, none of that. And what the report says is it comes out to about $122 million a year just in New York. The year ending May 31st, FedEx made $1.6 billion. How much of that is subsidized by you and me? I mean, stop and think about the advantage that they've got over, say, UPS, who pays their workers, what, something like $35 an hour, about $1,400 a week. They receive health care, retirement, all of that stuff. Oh, and UPS pays Social Security tax as well. Think about the competitive disadvantage UPS is at with FedEx. because, you know, this non-union independent contractor for a 60-hour week makes about $750 a week. Think about that. I'm talking almost half. And then you throw on top of that no Social Security, no unemployment, no workers' comp. Is this the model we want? Now, the group Drum Major Institute, they estimate there are 29,500 New York truck drivers who are listed as independent contractors who might otherwise be considered employees under the bill, just not FedEx. But they're saying about how they've written this, all of those other people are going to be covered except FedEx. That's the power of huge money. That's the power of massive lobbying strength. Think about it. And, you know, since they're all independent contractors, you can't organize them. Because as soon as you organize one of the little independent contractors, they just sell the route to somebody else, and bang, you're right back where you started from. That's the corporate way. And this misclassification just doesn't end with some truck drivers. It's a lot of people. And I've been following this story in Arizona. Remember me talking about the guy who, you know, the hero, the guy who was part of the Granite Mountain hotshot crew, you know, the people who go in and put out those forest fires, you know, the people who run to the danger, the people we put up on the pedestal, these are the heroes. 19 of them were killed. And they told the wife of one of them, well, you must have had some miscommunication in your marriage because your husband wasn't a full-time worker. Granted, he worked full-time hours, was there for a whole year, all of that stuff. But we didn't classify him as full-time. Today, the report comes out that, you know, of the 19 who died, 6 of them were classified as permanent employees, full-time employees by the city. The rest of them, the other 13, well, they were seasonal. So, sorry, oops, you don't get survivor benefits. Because that's the key distinction. If you were a full-time employee, you would get survivor benefits. Your loved ones behind you, they'd get some health insurance, pension payments. They'd get a life insurance policy, that kind of stuff. Could be worth, you know, $2 million. The 13 who didn't have the distinction, I'm sorry. So, oops, you know, should have been better classified. Is this how we treat the heroes? Is this how we treat any worker? And that's why it's so important to have laws that everyone plays by. And you don't give these exemptions to huge multinational corporations to exempt their people from the laws. And this is why government is so important, and non-partial government, saying, look, these are the rules. Everybody plays by them. The economy cannot function if you continue to allow the FedExes of the world and others to get exemptions and loopholes and all of this stuff that skews the system. And this thing in Arizona, man, has just got me scratching my head. I mean, if you're the city, do you want this bad PR? You're going to highlight what I've been saying for years, which is that, you know, you workers, you're just worker bees. You could be easily replaced. Or you must have some miscommunication in your marriage. But I give this woman credit. She's out there fighting for it. And I ask the question, you know, who's going to be the next hero with all of this stuff going on? I keep asking that question because we keep screwing those people, don't we? You look across the country, we're trying to figure out how to steal their pensions. You look across the country, you're trying to figure out how to take away their wages. Same thing with teachers, cops, you name it. All because our priorities are skewed. We prioritize profit over people. We prioritize tax handouts for the very well-to-do. And, you know, today is an interesting day because you go back in history. And I love to look to the past to see, you know, how do we get where we are? How did this all come about? And I like to blame Reagan for a lot, because there's an awful lot that he should be blamed for. But today, back in 1981, didn't take him long. Today, back in 1981, he signed the Economic Recovery Tax Act, or ERTA. And what ERTA did, just so you know, the big point of it, and there's some stuff in there, it basically dropped the tax rates for the very, very well-to-do from 70% down to 30%. You combine the 81, this ERTA, with the tax reform bill of 86, they dropped the tax rate from 70% down to somewhere around 28% for the very, very well-to-do. And one of my favorite things to say about the tax reform bill of 86, love that, reform. Lowered the top rate for the very well-to-do, raised the bottom rate. In fact, doubled it. Because, you know, those poor people have to have a stake in the game. And you look back to that period, that's when our mass inequality began. I mean, mass. That's when you began to see the creation of the world's largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. That's when you saw inequality, the jaws of inequality expand. Poverty continued to go up. And government under attack. Started today, 1981, with the signing of this horrible piece of legislation. Now, the right will tell you, well, it was those tax cuts that, you know, that created jobs. No, it didn't. The benefit was, there was no benefit. You had the Reagan recession. Thank you, supply-side economics. Thank you, trickle-down. Something that, if I remember right, George H.W. Bush called voodoo economics. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. DBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Remember yesterday we talked about the idiot who dressed up in the Obama clown suit and ran around. Turns out that the state fair there in Missouri, evidently they've imposed a lifetime ban on the rodeo clown. I gotta be honest, not in favor of lifetime bans. You know, people make mistakes, people do dumb things. I would have liked to seen him gored. That's a whole different ballgame, but this lifetime ban, not my thing. You do something dumb, you pay the price, you move on. Just silly in my view. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world in Washington, D.C. I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us, buddy.
Sure.
What do you think? A lifetime ban for the right has just got to be going nuts over this.
Yeah. I don't have a terrible amount, again, to add into this story. But it's crazy.
Just dumb. Just amazing stuff. Big news today on the American-U.S. Air merger. The Department of Justice is jumping in.
Hey, they're finally getting involved in this consolidation of the airline industry, which has been going on since about 2007. The Department of Justice today said they are going to be suing to stop this $11 billion merger. One of the reasons that both of these companies, U.S. Air and American, have said they want to merge is because it's a difficult industry, that they can put themselves in a less harmful position by consolidating their assets. The Department of Justice, there was a teleconference I was on today where the Assistant Attorney General, Bill Baer, was very vocal in shooting down these arguments. He was citing a number of internal communications at U.S. Airways among executives who were openly talking about how much that if they were to do this merger, that it would really, shut down competition across the industry. They would be able to raise prices here. And there are plenty of statistics that are cited by the Department of Justice, including some very cool graphs, which are available on our website, showing the impact that budget carriers like JetBlue have when they go into an airport that's dominated by big carriers. Almost immediately, they show that prices go down, in the case of DC's Reagan Airport, about 40% within a month. Wow. And to lose that competition, the Attorney General said, would be, quote, consumers getting the shaft, end quote, in this deal. So they are very much going to try everything they can in the course to try to shut down this merger.
But isn't that the American version of capitalism? The big fish always eats the little fish, and then the little fish gets screwed?
It certainly seems to be the trend. There is a pretty strong argument to be made here by even people who support, in principle, antitrust legislation being filed like this, who are saying if you really wanted to stop this sort of, competitive price fixing, if you will, almost, that they should have been blocking the mergers of the big carriers that happened a few years ago.
From the 70s. I mean, this has been going on since the 1970s. You've been seeing the big ones eating up the little ones and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, of course, going through bankruptcy a couple of times, screw those workers out of their pensions, set aside those contracts.
And come out of it stronger, which is what American Airlines did. Were found to be saying in a lot of these Department of Justice documents as well. If this merger goes through, 85% of domestic airline seats will be controlled by four airlines. There is a little bit of evidence that's been presented that so long as JetBlue and others can hold on to about 5-10%, that they can have a dampening effect on price rises. But we are reaching the point where even the best efforts of companies like Virgin America and JetBlue to keep prices down and to offer a very good service to customers, it's going to be impossible to stop the majority of people from paying higher fares if this kind of merger goes through.
No, at the end of the day, it's going to, in my view, a lot of this stuff comes down to you're going to have two or three companies, and that's going to be about it. I look at the trucking industry where I was fairly intimate and spent 20 years of my life. The whole move in trucking was consolidating into these big monster companies. And I remember reading something that Jimmy Hoffa said back in the 50s, which was eventually there'll be two companies. There'll be one union company, one non-union company, and there won't be much competition.
Well, that's certainly, I think, what's happened is there, again, are some very interesting statistics out here. They use Washington's Reagan Airport as the bulk of the data here, which is, you know, drawing some people's suspicion. But the reason the government's getting involved is it's because all the government employees are the ones who are going to be paying higher prices now. It's the people in St. Louis and Cincinnati and Memphis over the past 2 years who have been repeatedly screwed over by these mergers. And now that it hits D.C., they're throwing their hands up. But if this goes through, the combined U.S.-American airline will have 65% of round-trip flights out of Washington Reagan Airport, you know, and again, just further limiting the ability for anybody else to come in there and have gates at the airport. If you own all the gates, you're never going to allow competition to even sprout up. And JetBlue leases half of its gates currently from American Airlines in Washington, D.C., and many people suspect if this merger goes through, they will have their right to those gates yanked.
Well, good American capitalism, good stuff. In fact, owning all the whole thing and then letting people fight over the crumbs, that's it's beautiful. Mitch McConnell was talking about Obamacare today. I can't imagine anything good coming out of Mitch's mouth when you're talking about health care for Americans.
Well, good is all relative. I thought this was kind of entertaining. He said the reason he now is opposed to the unveiling of the state health insurance exchanges, which is scheduled October.
He's now opposed. When was he ever in favor of? Did I miss that memo? He was in favor at some point.
Well, he has a new reason,
okay.
which he hasn't applied to any other government website, which is that he says it's susceptible to cyber hackers. He doesn't want people's sensitive health information to be at risk. You know, this is people's social security numbers, etc. Be at risk because the data protection and encryption on this website is not up to snuff. You're not going to hear him complain about any of the other websites, but this one, for this reason alone, is enough for this major element of Obamacare to be postponed.
Interesting, but I also see that they're giving exemptions for the or holding off the time frame on the limits on out of pocket expenses.
Yeah.
Another year, I guess. Is this a good? Is this a bad thing? I mean, I got to be honest. You know, I see it as kind of a bad thing, but I kind of understand it.
What was cited here? So this is essentially a limit on out-of-pocket expenses going above a set rate. It's in the $6,000 range, I believe. A lot of companies have said that they use different carriers and different insurance middlemen to handle different types of out-of-pocket claims, and that it's, you know, above their pay grade to be able to figure out exactly how the money is being spent. So some of these big companies need extra time. In states where the health exchanges are going online on October 1st, these limits will be in place. So some people are fortunate enough to have this cap, but it is a lot of sort of, you know, medical advocacy groups, patient advocacy groups. I know the Multiple Sclerosis Association said one of the real reasons that encouraged them to endorse the Affordable Care Act, you know, a few years ago, was that this was in place. People with multiple sclerosis and other types of these diseases have tremendous out-of-pocket costs. They endorsed the bill because of these limits. They're now saying they're very frustrated that the government didn't expect this sort of complication to arise when, you know, there's probably was ample evidence that these companies would be complaining here at the finish line about having it all done in time.
Yeah, I'm very frustrated with the whole process too, because you know we've had all this time to work this stuff out here in Pennsylvania, for instance. They're not even. I don't think anybody's actually talking about setting up anything that resembles an exchange here. Our governor's not taking the Medicaid expansion money. I'm hoping that we get the federal plan, whatever that is, because you know I look at our governor, who nothing good comes out of his office.
It's certainly another case where even legislation that is thousands of pages long does not really account for all the complexities of this current insurance model. And, you know, I have to admit I'm joining the, I have to say, growing choir of people who say this needs to be remedied at the federal level. This sort of bill that continues to work within the same model of private insurance really just doesn't seem to be working very well. And I wish there were more options. I wish there were public options.
No, I wish there was the option of me buying into Medicare.
It's the best system out there from almost any angle you can look at it from.
I mean, and that would have been the simple choice in this. Fine, keep your private plans, Give me the choice between a private plan and the Medicare. Get younger people into Medicare so we solve that problem, you know, in the years to come, because you get younger people and maybe not using as much health care, funding it a little bit better. Give me the option and let the public and private compete.
Yeah, it seems like common sense to me. I'm waiting for a president to take this on. I think some people were skeptical of Barack Obama initially, at least compared to Hillary Clinton on this issue. I was more of the Hillary Clinton camp on this, but my history is a little bit tinted. But it may be some time until we're hearing that articulated on a big stage, and I think that's a shame because we may just be digging ourselves into a bigger hole as we see this law continue to sort of sputter down the road.
Yeah, and speaking of Hillary, she gave a big speech today, or was it yesterday? She gave a big speech yesterday at the American Bar Association, and so it was some pretty good stuff, actually.
I'll check it out. I didn't see it. I believe she talked about voting rights. That's the only sort of a news clip I even just saw the title of for that. But every indication is she will be running in 2016, so I wouldn't be surprised that she's dotting the landscape 2 years out with some big speeches.
Yeah, I mean, she hit the saying the old demons of discrimination are rearing their heads, and anyone who thinks that racial discrimination is no longer a problem must not be paying attention. She'll be giving a foreign policy speech, or a policy speech on national security in Philadelphia, I guess, sometime next month.
Well, I'll check it out. I'll be watching very eagerly to see how she performs in this new public role.
Now let's talk about what's going on in Israel. Evidently, more peace talks?
These are the same peace talks we were talking about a few weeks ago. They're actually officially beginning. Everything that happened back in D.C. about 2 weeks ago was just preliminary. So tomorrow the two sides will sit down in Jerusalem. They'll be visited by the Secretary General of the U.N. later this week. This is a trip I kind of wish I'd gone on with him, going to Jordan, Palestine, the Palestinian West Bank, and to Israel. This news comes as is the Israeli government approved the release of 26 Palestinian prisoners. Many of them have been jailed for quite some time, and a large number of them for killing Israeli citizens. So there's been a lot of pushback within the Israeli government to this, but it was a Palestinian precondition, apparently, to these talks, and Israel went along with it. It's part of a phased release of prisoners, but in exchange, 1,000 new settlements have been announced by the Israelis within the occupied Palestinian territories. And John Kerry has said they're illegitimate, but they will go ahead nonetheless as these peace talks begin tomorrow.
And Kerry, I saw something that he said, don't overreact. They're just going to build these anyway.
Don't overreact. This is only the major source of frustration for one of the sides at the peace talks. We'll see. The Palestinians say this is not enough of a provocation by Israel to encourage them to drop out of the talks. That's a good thing. Many people say they've seen this coming for quite some time, but it is a further example of at least one side in these talks just digging its heels in before any concessions are going to be made at the table.
Can any concessions be made? I mean, this has been going on since the beginning of basically time. But do you see any way of this ever going away?
There is some speculation. There was a very good article in the New York Review of Books, in the most recent issue, talking about the fact there are some large trends, occurring within the Palestinian population, as well as in Israel, that may point to, the fact there's greater acknowledgement among Israel's leader that the settlements cannot continue indefinitely. That seems to be a little bit betrayed by the fact that new settlements are beginning as we speak. But there may be reasons to think that this is the closest we've been in quite some time. I don't want to promise beyond that.
Yes,
so, we've had a lot of things touched on, judicial reform, criminal reform. Here, Mayor Bloomberg has staunchly been behind the stop-and-frisk policy, which yesterday U.S. District Court Judge Shira Scheindlin said is unconstitutional. The Commissioner of Police, Ray Kelly, who's a big figure here in New York politics, as well as the mayor, held a press conference saying this is really going to hamper, the ability for the New York City Police Department to go about their work. Bloomberg was threatening whether or not people are really committed in this city to eliminating crime. There were headlines in a lot of the tabloid newspapers today saying this is was a return to the Wild West of New York because this policy is no longer in effect. We will see whether the end of this sort of racial profiling leads to an increase in the murder rate. But for now, I think we are right to be celebrating that a policy that on its surface, and the more you looked into it, it seemed to be racially fueled, is now not allowed.
Well, why would you say, you know, because I had someone throw this at me recently. Well, why would you say it's racially fueled? You know, people are in bad neighborhoods and, you know, the police are just doing their job. How do you know it's racially motivated? How do you know they're profiling?
You know, I didn't have a chance to sit in on the trial, but I believe there were hundreds of pages of evidence brought forward to show that it was not, you know, evidence of any particular risk that motivated these detentions, if you will, and involuntary searches. There are, you know, were body-worn cameras that were used in one borough to try to show that this was racially targeted program. You know, I don't have the evidence myself, but there is a 200-page court ruling that proves it all. And you know, anyone looking for that evidence can find it pretty easily.
Well, the one thing that really jumped out at me is that they made more than 533,000 stops last year. 87% of them were black or Latino. To me, that I don't know how you get around that.
They'll say it's because of the neighborhoods, because it just happens that where the crime is in those sorts of districts, but that doesn't explain why there are such low numbers in the Hispanic population and others that are in those neighborhoods as well. The statistics, I think, are pretty damning on this.
And finally, Eric Holder yesterday announced going to kind of try and do away with some of the minimum mandatory sentences for drugs and all that?
Yeah, I think you may have laughed at me at the time when I said this may be a political decision because of the changing sentiment, particularly about the number of people in prison for marijuana-related nonviolent crimes. It does seem very much to be the case that this is something that Obama and his supporters actually thought they were going to get around to making some progress on quite some time ago. That extends to the crack versus powder cocaine sentencing guidelines, which also really haven't changed as much as many people hope. Some belated movement in criminal justice reform. We have prisons in this country operating at about 40% over capacity, and just, you know, dramatic measures really are needed to try to sort things out. And just to give these companies that are profiting off of the number of prisoners a few fewer bodies to have to take care of.
Yeah, but less profit for the big corporations. You know, the whole pot thing to me just seems dumb. I mean, I just saw that last week there was a story that caught my attention. I think it was in Texas, in Temple, Texas, where this couple had, you know, had a 2-year-old. Evidently they got caught smoking pot while the kid was sleeping. Child Protective Services took the kid away, and the kid ends up getting killed in foster care.
There you go. I think we're having a national change of heart on this. It is way overdue. I talked to my parents who were alive and participating quite heavily in the 60s, and they said if they had been told then that we would still be arguing about this in the year 2000, let alone here in 2013, it would be absurd. It is absurd, and it's good to see at least some acknowledgement of that, even though it comes via a roundabout explanation from Mr. Holder.
Well, you got to understand, and I'm sure your parents will tell you, it was the Reagan years. Just say no. It was Nancy. Just say no. I lived through it. Everything was just say no. And, of course, punish like crazy if you are caught. But anyway, I'm glad to see it. I hope it goes as well. Luke, it's always great talking to you, man.
You as well. Take care.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The failure of our corporate and political leaders to make sure every worker gets good health care is causing some unpleasant consequences, not just for them, but for all of us. Consequences like stomach flu. Ill workers often spread illness. This is because millions of employees who deal directly with the public, as well as with co-workers, are not covered by paid sick leave policies. So, when they come down with something like stomach flu, they still tend to drag themselves to work rather than going to bed until they recover. For staying home means a loss of pay, or even loss of their jobs. Low-wage workers, such as those in the restaurant industry, are particularly vulnerable and, since they handle food, particularly threatening. Nearly 80% of America's food service workers receive no paid sick leave, and researchers have found that about half of them go to work ill because they fear losing their jobs if they don't. As a result, a study by the Centers for Disease Control finds that ill workers are causing as much as 80% of America's stomach flu outbreaks, which is one reason that CDC officials have declared our country's lack of paid sick leave to be a major public health threat. You'd think the industry itself would be horrified enough by this endangerment of its workforce and customers that it would either take the obvious curative step of providing the leave or of pushing in the name of public safety for a public sick leave program. But, au contraire, amigos, such huge and hugely profitable chains as McDonald's, Red Lobster, and Taco Bell not only failed to provide such sensible care for their employees, but have lobbied furiously against city and state efforts to require paid sick days. This is Jim Hightower saying, all top executives who never touch the food their chains serve get paid sick leave. For them to deny it to workers is idiotic, short-sighted, and even more sickening than stomach flu.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
They discriminate by race and age. Won't pay nobody living wage. Walmart's here, let's all rejoice. Everyone is gone and we got no choice. So Walmart, kill the country soul.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So today, organizing for action volunteers, they went and handed out, I guess, 135 climate denier awards and little unicorn trophies, according to an email distributed by OFA. 135 of them, Michelle Bachmann being one of them. This unicorn trophy going out to the people who deny that there's global warming. And you know, the thing that gets me is that, you know, NASA, who I think most people don't see as a partisan group, NASA says that, you know, 97% of scientists accept science, the science of climate change. Yet 55% of the congressional Republicans, including the guy who is the chair of the House Science Subcommittee on Environment, a guy named Chris Stewart, Republican from Utah. 55% of the Republicans and him, the guy who's the head of the subcommittee, they reject climate change.
Ah, it's not man-made. Not possible.
Yeah. You know, we were in, we were at the Hoover Dam, and all around the Hoover Dam looked like a bathtub ring. And it's, you know, it's probably 50 feet, maybe even more. I mean, it looks like just a small band, but you're talking about a mountain, a huge, huge band where there used to be water, where there's not. I wonder where that went. Anyway, again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you got something on your mind, questions, comments, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do appreciate all of the contacts and the engagement. But another great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the blue sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming to the evil best.